You know, my name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. I have to start by thanking you. You know, my wife Polly and I, you'll meet her, are so profoundly touched by your generosity and your friendliness. And, you know, we lived in California for, until about a year ago, we lived in Los Angeles. And so, you know, that makes me one of the fruits and nuts. And this may be a little bit California speak, but the energy in your country and in your city is just so soothing to my spirit, to our spirit. You know, it is so easy and so nice to be here, and we thank you so much for inviting us. We are having a wonderful time. I don't know if I mentioned that I'm an alcoholic or not, but I happen to be that too, and I have an AA home group, and that is the Third Legacy Group in Bellingham, Washington. And we don't live in Bellingham. That's a city of about 70,000 people. We live in a little village about 30 kilometers from there. And so I come from a remote corner of the U.S., and my home group is called the Third Legacy Group because the third legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous, our three legacies are unity, recovery, and service, and the third legacy is service. And so our group is named for that third legacy. And I have a sponsor, and my sponsor's name is Keith Lewis, and Keith lives in Wilmington, North Carolina. And I don't know if I remember to mention my last name, but it's Pistol. You think that's funny. My wife's name is Polly. It sounds like some sort of striptease dancer, doesn't it? And to those of you who may be new here and who are somewhat alarmed because I am throwing out not only my last name but my sponsors, that is in keeping with our tradition of anonymity at the public level. So my sponsor wants you to know his last name so that if you're ever in Wilmington, North Carolina, and don't know where there's an AA meeting, you can look him up in the phone book. And you'll be able to find him. And if you ever come to the northwest corner of Washington, you'll be able to find me and Polly, and perhaps we can be of some service to you in helping you find a meeting or give you a little food or a place for the night or whatever you need. You know, we're not picky. And so I called my sponsor one time and I said, Keith, you know, I just happen to think, I think it's important to tell people when you speak at an AA function that, you know, that you have been sober for a while and to tell them, you know, that you do the things you tell them they need to do, you know, that you have a home group and that you have a sponsor. And I said, okay, if I mention your name. And he said, oh, no, by all means, I would like for you to mention it, and I'd like for you to mention it my full name, you know. Because one of the benefits of being sober is that you can be listed in the phone book. And we are so delighted to be here, and we are so profoundly grateful that you have invited us. And I am so grateful to see some old friends that I have not seen in a long time, two or three years, and that is the people from Iceland. We just really fell in love with him when we were there a couple of years ago. I don't even remember how long it's been, but it hasn't been all that long. So, perhaps we should get on with this. I'm glad so many of you are here. I'm glad that we have some newcomers here. I'm assuming that's what some of you who stood up were. Is that right? No. Well, okay. So if you are, oh, those are the people from out of town, right? Oh, okay. So if you are, and you know, and I'm I'm really sorry that you have to suffer through this in English. You know, I don't speak Danish, and you know, our country's got two big oceans, one on each side, and there's not very much pressure on you to learn any language other than English, and that's unfortunate at this moment in time. But thank you so much for enduring this. But I don't know why you came to Alcoholics Anonymous if you're new here. I don't know what your expectations were. Possibly you came for the same reason that I did. You may not fully understand for some time why you might have come here to begin with. I didn't understand for a long time exactly why I came here. It's not important why you came here. It's not important why you're an alcoholic. I used to think it was terribly important to find out why I'm an alcoholic. What happened? It seems like it ought to contribute, that knowledge should contribute something to the solution. It doesn't, but it seems like it should. We come here for many different reasons. Some people come to Alcoholics Anonymous because, their wife or husband says, you know, if you don't do something about your drinking, I'm leaving. At work, they may tell you that, if you don't do something about your drinking, you can't work here anymore. You know, in California, we had people that came to AA looking for romance. and if that happens to be why you came, I should tell you that the odds are good. Unfortunately, the goods are odd. My wife sponsors a lot of women, many of them unmarried, and they call sometimes on weekends, and we sort of wind up, in a sense, we co-sponsor everybody, and so they'll call up and say, "Hi, Dave, is Polly there?" "No, she's not, sweetheart. She's out of town." "Oh, well, have you got a minute?" And I say, "You bet." And so then they proceed to tell me problems they're having with their boyfriend. And I say, "Well, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, see, and we don't interview royalty or the graduating class of universities. Are people like that for membership? You know, we get our members from jails and hospitals. And, this is not the prime place to find your Prince Charming." So anyway, our book Alcoholics Anonymous. At the end of chapter 5 that we normally read in the U.S., I think you usually read this here too in meetings, in the chapter 5, the last paragraph says that our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. So I'll spend a few minutes telling you how that affects me and how that applies to me. The description of the alcoholic, the big book has a lot of information which describes alcoholics, alcoholic behavior, alcoholic thinking. And perhaps, to me, the most telling information is to be found in the doctor's opinion, where it says that we have a problem with drinking because of a thing called the phenomena of craving. That once we take a drink, we can no longer predict our behavior. We lose control of things. And that pretty much goes with all addictive problems, you know, all compulsive, obsessive behavior. You know, whether your problem is food or gambling or whatever. Once in our case, alcoholics, once you take a drink, you can't predict what's going to happen. You don't know where you're going to wind up. You don't know, you know, you can expect to, if you stay with it long enough and really dedicate yourself to drinking, you can look forward to waking up from time to time, not knowing where you are, not knowing where your clothes are, not knowing who that person is in bed with you, not knowing where your car is, and that is just the nature of it, and that happens because, you know, and aren't we always ashamed? Oh, I've done it again. How did this happen? And, you know, and we think that, you know, we just should have had four drinks, not 12. And it doesn't occur to us until we get here and somebody tells us that it wasn't four. The fourth drink didn't do it. The 12th drink didn't do it. The 50th drink didn't do it. The first drink did it. The first drink is what did it. As soon as we take a drink, it's over. Because the phenomena of craving sets in and we can't stop. And that is what Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion of the big book, says, that alcoholics can best be described as those people who experience the phenomenon of craving when they take a drink. The chapter to the agnostic, which is the next part of that paragraph, we have a chapter in the big book called We Agnostics, and to me that you know that the existence of that chapter is a clear sign of God's working in our program. See, when Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, the founders of our program, when Bill wrote that chapter, he had been sober about 3 years at that time. And I don't know, and that chapter does something that to me is absolutely incredible. I consider it actually a miracle. That chapter makes God approachable. And I don't know how, I don't know anybody that has 3 years of sobriety that can write a few paragraphs that will make God approachable. No, I mean, that is a non-threatening way to get introduced to God. You know, I don't know what you came here with as far as ideas are concerned about God. I came here with some seriously flawed ideas about God. But that chapter disarmed all of my fear, all of my anger, and all of my arrogance about God. And I consider that truly a hallmark of how miraculous this program really is. And then it talks about our personal adventures before and after, make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. You know, I spent my whole career, as a computer scientist. Yeah, I'm a geek. And I never one time made a decision that I thought would be harmful to me. Still haven't. I never one time said, I think I'll make some bad decisions today. I think I'll do something to see if I can't really tear my life up, you know. I think I'll get to see if I can't do something that will make my wife leave me. Maybe today I'll see if I can't get fired from my job. Maybe today I'll have a car accident. I never made decisions like that. You know, but doing the very best job I could to have a successful life and one that I would enjoy living, I turned me into a derelict. I turned me into a derelict single-handedly, unassisted. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was drinking 6 half-gallons of vodka per week. A half gallon, I think, is about a liter and a half. And I drank 6 of those a week. And I'm a little anal, so I know exactly how many it was because I bought a case every Friday. See, I was, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was unemployed and I was unemployable. And I got an unemployment check. I happened to be living down in Texas at the time. And I got an unemployment check every week from the Texas Unemployment Commission, $63. I would take that and cash my check and go down and buy a case of vodka. And that's what I drank from Friday to Friday. And my diet at that time consisted of a little frozen chicken dinner that had three pieces of chicken in it. You always got a wing. They always put a wing in. And one skinny little leg and one little thigh. And then there were some little green pellets over in one corner that the package said were English peas. I think they were just little green plastic balls. And over on the other side, there was some white goop that the package said was mashed potatoes. But whatever that was, that had never seen the ground. And that was my sole diet. And if I remembered to do it, I would pop one of those in the oven. And if I remembered to take it out before it burned, I would try to eat some of it. And other than that, I just drank. And I had been doing that for some time. I had been a daily... I was 40 years old when I came here. And I had been a daily drinker since I was about 19 or 20. And I had been an alcoholic. I had been drinking alcoholically, which means to me, the advanced stages of alcoholic drinking, that means to me that if my eyes are open, I'm drinking. The only time I'm not drinking is when I'm unconscious. So I had been drinking alcoholically for a long, long time, and I was in extremely bad physical condition, and I had not had a bath in about, I'm really not sure, you know, but weeks, months, nor brush my teeth, nor comb my hair, I had no idea how long it had been since I'd changed my clothing. Because see, if you stay with it, if you don't give up and you stay with it, things like bathing and putting on clean clothes and taking care of yourself become totally irrelevant. It don't matter. You know, you smell about as bad as you're going to smell in 2 or 3 weeks. So, you know, that part doesn't get any worse. That is just one of the many eventualities of unchecked alcoholism. You know, you just go to hell. Now, the question then becomes, when I presented myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, or when you have anybody that has let their life get in such dilapidated condition, the question becomes, what are we going to do with this? You know, how did this happen? Well, very subtle. It was very subtle. There wasn't any dramatic moment in my progression from just a kid, you know, 18, 19-year-old kid, having fun, to being a 40-year-old derelict. Nothing dramatic happened. It just gradually got worse and worse. I found alcohol, and I knew the first time I drank as much booze as I got as I wanted to. People sometimes, alcoholics like to think they are unique or at least special. You know, I am so typical. You know, I have found that I am not only unique, I am typical. I drank too much the first time out, and I got sick, and I threw up, and, you know, and I woke up the next morning lying on the beach in the sand, and the hot sun was beating down on me, and I was sick, and I felt bad, and, you know, it was just such a typical outing for a kid, you know, just drink too much and throw up and get sick. But I woke up thinking, man, I can't wait to do that again. Because see, for about, hey, you laugh, but the magic happened to you too, or you wouldn't be here. Yeah. You know, for about 15 or 20 minutes there, my life was okay. For about 15 or 20 minutes, I felt safe. I felt okay. I wasn't ugly anymore. My freckles had fallen off. You know, my jokes were funny. The girls thought I was amusing. You know, it was just wonderful. That's the first time in my life I'd ever felt like that. If you think I'm going to give that up, you're crazy. No way. So I just slowly watch my life, you know, from afar now, you know, because I've been sober for a long time. And from afar, I watch my life how it just slowly goes downhill. I just slowly degenerate into a bum. It looked good for a while. Looked really good. I'm a computer scientist. I had really good jobs. You know, I was a big deal for a long time, in my own mind, at least. And you know, I had some really impressive jobs. I enjoyed my work. I really had a good time being a computer scientist. It was fun. You know, I came through the. I started it. You know, back in the late 50s, I was just 19 years old. And I went through the whole spectrum of things. The first computer I worked on was a vacuum tube computer. That's how long ago it was. She's laughing. She says, this guy's older than he looks. And I liked it. I didn't want to screw it up. But I just slowly got to the point where I was unemployable as a computer scientist. And so I went through marriages, you know. I treated my children badly. My son has died, but he was 9 years sober when he died. He's an alcoholic. He was an alcoholic. My daughter's an alcoholic. She's 2 years sober. And, you know, I just, because we infect everybody, you know, we infect everybody around us. You know, we damage people around us. And so I found that, you know, that my life was just unmanageable. Actually, what I found out was that my life is not at all unmanageable. My life is just unmanageable by me. You know, it is unmanageable by me. The next idea that we have is that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. I looked around, you know, and who were the powerful humans? Doctors are powerful. I needed to get cured of alcoholism, so I did what my Western heritage taught me to do. I called a doctor. And I mean, I never even considered Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even remember if I even knew anything about AA. I probably heard. Oh, I do. Yes, I had. I remember. I had heard. We used to joke about AA in the bars. You know, we used to say things like, "The difference between a drunk and an alcoholic is that a drunk doesn't have to go to all those meetings." So I called, being rather grandiose at that time. I hope I'm still not, but I was it then, at least then. And I called the American Medical Association and asked them to recommend a doctor who could treat me for excessive drinking. And I probably called it alcoholism, but I don't remember. You know, when you're drinking that much vodka, things get a little hazy. But they recommended a doctor. I went to see this doctor. And this doctor said, you know, it's like he put a mirror under my nose to see if I could frost it, you know, I guess to see if I was a lion. You know, and he bangs my knee with a little rubber hammer. And he whips out his prescription pen and he writes me a prescription. And he said, "Here, I want you to take these as directed and then come back in 2 weeks." So I took the prescription. And it was for Librium, a tranquilizer, to be taken every day. Well now, my first wife was a nurse. And she used to bring home a book from the office called The Physician's Desk Reference. And this is a book that doctors have in the U.S., and it shows every drug made on the planet. Okay, it gives you pictures of all these drugs, and it tells you what's likely to happen to you if you put some in your body. So I was able to order just about anything I wanted from that book. She would just order it through the doctor's office. And I had been taking amphetamines and had Valium when things got too bad. I had Valium available if I needed it. But I liked amphetamines. You know, if you have an unlimited supply of amphetamines, which I did, I bought it in bottles of 1,000, you know, two or three bottles at a time. And I got it for next to nothing. You know, it was only about $6 a bottle. And, you know, it was so cheap, I it never occurred to me to sell it. I just gave it away to my friends. You know, if you're giving away free speed, you can build up a hell of an entourage. Some people like to hang out with you. And so I knew about drugs, you know, and I looked at that prescription, and the thought occurred to me, oh my God, this is hopeless. Man, if this is all I have, this is not going to help. This is going to make it worse. Now, you know, the doctor said this will cause you to drink less. Well, yeah, you're going to spend a lot more time unconscious. No? You can't take tranquilizers and drink and stay upright as long as you used to. So that powerful human didn't help me at all. You know, I mean, in fact, he made me think that, you know, what's wrong with me is quite possibly hopeless. No, I talked to ministers. They're powerful. I've talked to ministers about my problem along the way. And, you know, I just don't connect with them somehow or other. I don't know why, you know, and that's not, I sincerely do not fault them for anything. I do not fault churches. I have no quarrel with churches. I go to church now, usually every Sunday when I'm at home. Now, I have no problem at all with it now. But ministers, I don't know what they tried to say for sure, but I do know what I heard. And what I heard is probably not what they tried to say. But what I heard was, look, Dave, we own God, see? And if you want to get to God, you got to go through us. You got to do it our way. And here's what you have to do to make yourself presentable to God. See, I couldn't do that. I mean, I just couldn't rise to the level of purity that they seem to require for God to help me. I just couldn't do it. So I didn't try. You know, I just gave up. I went to a therapist. You know, I told a story the other night about a guy from Rhode Island. His name was Rowland Hazzard. He's mentioned fairly often in AA literature. And he was a bad alcoholic, and he could afford to go anywhere he wanted to for treatment. His family was so wealthy. And he spent a year working with Dr. Carl Jung in Switzerland. And at the end of the year, Dr. Jung said, "You're about as well as I'm going to be able to make you. I think you're going to be okay." And Roland got on a train, went to Paris, was met by some friends, and 15 minutes later was drunk. And he was just dismayed. You know, how could this have happened? So he went back to Sweden. And, went back to Switzerland. And he said, you know, what happened? And Dr. Jung says, you know, Roland, the truth is, I can't help you. And I don't know anything or anybody that can help you. All I know is that the only thing I have ever seen that's been effective against the problem that you have is some kind of religious or spiritual experience, and I don't know how to induce those. I don't know how to make you have one of those. I went to a therapist. I went to the county mental health clinic, and I had a therapist. Every Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock, I went to see my therapist. Her name was Jeanette Beavers. And I remember her well, and for some strange reason. But I went to see her, and every Monday afternoon, I spent an hour with her. And I'd go down there and tell her what was wrong with my life. You know, look at all the things that have happened to me. You know what? As I recall, I look back on her, telling her all about my life, you know, and those ungrateful women I had married and those intolerant people I had worked for who had fired me and all that. You know, none of this was my fault. None of it was my fault. Look what they did to me. Look what all those people have done to me. You know what AA has taught me? AA has taught me that I am not a victim. I am not a victim. My troubles are of my own making. And that, although I did not like that at first, did you? That's the good news. If my troubles are of your making, I'm screwed. Before I get any better, I have to get you to change. If I can admit that my troubles are of my own making, I can do whatever I want to about it. And you can do whatever you want to do. And it'll be okay. But I told this lady all my problems. Told her how badly I'd been treated. And see, the problem is, when you go to a therapist and you're an alcoholic, you don't feel any particular responsibility to tell them the truth. The truth is ugly. You know, I wanted her to like me. You know, what the hell do I care about the truth? To heck with the truth. How do I look? You know, do you like me? Oh. So, the therapist, see, and that's the big hole when it comes to therapies. We lie to them. You know, a fundament of therapy is that you know, you go to your therapist, you tell your therapist how you react to life around you. You know, how you react to the world, how you act and react to your life. And they can, from your information, they can see the flaw in your thinking and help direct you, you know, help you change your course so that your life will be better. Well, if everything you tell them is just fantasy, you know, that varies from time to time, depends on which Monday, you know, that I'm there, then, you know, I have totally crippled this lady. She doesn't have a prayer to help me. And finally, one day I said, when are we going to talk about my drinking? And she said, oh, do you have a drinking problem? Oh, therapists are so good. You know, she probably spotted this problem about 37 seconds after I walked into her office for the first time. And she let me come every Monday and sit there and spew out all this drivel. I don't know how she took it. Waiting for me to bring up the drinking. It's like, you know, it's like the tiger laying in the bushes waiting for somebody to walk by, and as soon as they do, they pounce. And so she said, Dave, you know, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, oh, why would you want me to go there? She says, because their program works better than anything. She said, you know, we have a government program here. I can put you in it if you want to, but it won't help you much. She says, you know, they mean well. You know, but, and this was before treatment centers became very, seven silver, since you know, the sinking of the Bismarck. You know, but she said they do better than anybody. And she didn't tell me this. I found out later, you know, but she could have, and it would have meant nothing to me at the time. She didn't tell me I had an incurable disease that I was going to have to treat for the rest of my life, that I was going to have to pay attention to, take note of for the rest of my life. But she knew where to send me. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And the third idea is that God could and would, if you ask Him to. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with all the defiant individuality and grandiosity that we have. You know, I had my full share of that when I walked in. If I'd known where I was coming, I don't think I would have come. I did not want to go down and just associate with you people. You know, you are alcoholics after all. See, and I knew. I've always been prescient. You know, I've always known things. I don't have to read books or you know, I know things. And I knew. And I knew that where she was asking me to go was going to be a dingy room full of old derelicts, you know, old bums. They were going to have on tennis shoes and no socks and rope belts and no shaves and no teeth and, you know, just scruffy old bums. And I'm pleased to report that there was such a person in my first meeting, and it was me. I went into my first meeting, and you know, nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous ever broke faith with AA. Nobody ever broke faith with it in my case. I went in there, and they said a lot of different things, but one of the things that they clearly said was, "Dave, we do not have enough power individually or collectively to get you sober or keep you sober. We recommend that you ask God to help you." Now, well, oh, come on. Oh, man. Oh, boy. And you said, no. Not that God from your childhood. You know, we want you to stop for a moment and think about what God needs to be for you. What should God be? What do you think God should be? And that's who He is for you. And that's the way you pray to Him. And I said, oh, you can't do that. And you said, oh yeah, that's the way we do it here. Very casual. Oh yeah, that's how we do it. And I thought, oh my God. Well, my next thought was, oh, well, see, you don't understand. That was my big... That was my big pitch when I got here. You don't understand. I said, you know, I don't think I really believe in God. And you said, oh, we don't care. It doesn't matter. See, you didn't make any sense to me. I mean, you're like, what do you mean you don't care? It doesn't matter. If it doesn't matter, how come I have to pray to Him? You know? So I came to my first meeting on Wednesday night, April the 14th, 1976, drunk because my eyes had been open for more than a few hours. And you tolerated me. You know, that's when I see fussy people complaining about people who are drinking in AA meetings. I want to let you know that you tolerated me when I came to your meeting drunk. I mean, that's the only way I could get there. I couldn't get there any other way. I came to my second meeting the next night, Thursday night. Why didn't I come to my second meeting? Because at my first meeting, a little lady named Helen Elliott walked up to me, and as bad as I looked and as bad as I smelled, she put her arms around me and she said, "We're glad you're here and we hope you come back." And you know, I knew she meant it. It wasn't flashy stuff. She meant it. She wasn't showing off. She wasn't trying to get a gold star for the day. She meant it. I couldn't believe it. So I went back the next night, drunk again. "You told me the same thing. You know, you treated me just as well as you did the first night, and you told me the same thing again. Come home tonight and ask God to help you." And I went back Friday night, drunk, and you told me the same thing. And I went back Saturday night, drunk, and you told me the same thing. "Go home tonight and ask God to help you." And by this time, I am beginning to see a little hope. You have not shown any signs of throwing me out. You've not made the slightest move toward throwing me away. And I went home and I did what you asked me to do. It was against my better judgment. You know, it's like against your better judgment. Who cares about your judgment? You don't even have a job. I did it against my better judgment, and I, to the best of my recollection, I had not the slightest hope that it would work, that anything would happen. But on April the 17th, I said the little prayer, "God, if I'm going to get sober, you're going to have to help me because I can't do it by myself." And I knew that was true. I knew that was true. I could not do it. And my sobriety day is April the 18th. The very next day. Here is a point that I get a little bit concerned about sometimes. And that is that you will hear someone else's miracle and expect that you're going to get it treated exactly the same way. And that if you don't, you know, God doesn't love you or something's wrong. You know. And I want to tell you, nothing is wrong. You know, the book says great events will come to pass. The great events that come to pass in your life will be your great events. They may not be great events for me, but they'll be great events for you. God may not answer your prayer the same way He answered mine, but He'll answer it. This room is a room full of miracles. I mean, where would we all be if I got some kind of special treatment? Who would want a God like that? So that is not at all what I believe. I believe that my prayer was answered so quickly because my first sponsor was a doctor. He was a very prominent doctor. He was at my first meeting. He was the first man to greet me when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Michael Healy. He was in Dallas. And he said, after I'd been sober about 6 months, "The first night you came, I almost didn't bother to shake your hand because from the looks of you, I was convinced you would be dead in 3 days." Now, what's important about that? I can tell you exactly what's important to me about that, and that is that I did something that you asked me to do just because I liked you. I responded. That's a bad way to say it. I responded to the love you showed me. I responded to that. I didn't want to be separated from you. I did it because you asked me to do it. I didn't want to come back the next day and say, I won't do what you ask. I did it because you asked me to. Did I think it was going to work? Nah. I just wanted to tell you I did it and it didn't work. I didn't want you to throw me out. I did something against my better judgment that I did not believe would work just because you told me to. And you would have let me fight with you over that as long as I wanted to. You know, we can't make you do anything, Dave. We can't force you to do it. Here's our advice. You know, we know that your life can be fantastic. But we're not, you know, we don't have any police in here. We don't have any rules in here. Isn't it nice that we have traditions, not rules? God could and would if he were sought. When I came here, one of my big problems with God is that, I thought he was mean, short-tempered, easily angered, nosy, insecure. I mean, who could need that much worship and praise if they weren't insecure? And I thought he was the chief enforcer of a lot of very stringent rules, none of which were fun or easy, most of which were impossible to follow, at least possible for me to follow. He is not a friendly force in the universe. You know, I look in what little I know, what little I still know about religious people is they talk about a God-fearing home. You know, and that's just kind of scary stuff. And that was my opinion of God when I got here. And after being sober for all this time, my opinion of God today is that he's very kind, he's very loving, he's very enthusiastic that we're all here tonight. He would like for us all to enjoy him. He enjoys us. He is forgiving. I mean, doesn't it make sense? I mean, he's loving. He's kind. Doesn't it make sense he would be that way? Doesn't it make sense that God would practice what he preaches? Doesn't it make sense that if God, as you understand him, would like for you to be loving and kind and helpful, that's the way he would be? Loving and kind and helpful? I mean, you hear a lot of talk in here about forgiveness, you know. How could I not be, you know, when I stop to think about it, how could I not be forgiving? Look how you and God have forgiven me. Look at what I brought you, you know, to work with. An old smelly drunk. And you have embraced me. You have held me. You have stood me up. You have helped me get my life and affairs back in order. God has seen to it that the obsession of drink has been removed. I mean, how could I not be forgiving? Look how I have been forgiven. Where would I be if there were no forgiveness? Dead. That's the short answer. Dead. So I'm very pleased that I'm able to say the things I'm saying tonight. Among other things, because my life is absolutely incredible today. I don't know if you would enjoy living my life, but I am loving living my life. I love who I am. I have lost interest in what you think of me. I mean, it's okay with me. However you feel about me, it's okay with me. It's okay. You know, I used to say, I don't care how you feel about me. And I said, it's okay. You know, the world is okay. The world I live in is okay. You know, God has given me an angel for my wife. It's not important if you think she's an angel or not. I do. It's important that I do, and I do. You know, she exactly fills the hole I have. You know, it's a Polly and God size hole. I had two big holes. One fit Polly, the other one fit God. And both my holes are filled. You know, I adore my wife. You know, I have learned probably more from my wife than anybody else. See, when I got here, I was way too macho to say things like that. You know. My wife taught me about generosity. See, I came from an incredibly poor home, you know, I mean, just abject poverty. And my opinion was, up until the time I met her, and for some time after, and I met her after I'd only been sober about a year and a half. So I had not been wrapped very tight yet. And my opinion was, share? What do you mean share? There's already not enough to go around. I'm not sharing anything. And Polly taught me the benefits of generosity. you know. Just, and you know how she did it? She did it just by being generous. She didn't do it by telling me what I should do. I watch her all the time, and I see how easily her life works in many cases. I watch her do things sometimes that I would not do. Okay, I mean, it's against my better judgment, you know, my keen alcoholic mind says, and you know, you never hear people in Al-Anon meetings talking about keen alcoholic minds. Only in AA meetings do you hear people talk about keen alcoholic minds. But my keen alcoholic mind, you know, just said, I wouldn't do that at all. But the truth is, sometimes I think, you know, but her way is better than mine. Even though I don't know if I could do it her way is better than mine. And I'm not going to criticize her or say anything that could be misconstrued as criticism, because I don't want to discourage that kind of behavior in her. Can you believe that I could possibly have ideas like that? I can't. You know, I mean, you haven't known me all my life like I have. I can't believe I could have ideas like that. I learned every bit of that here. I came here an arrogant jerk. And you have made someone of me that I like. I am easy to forgive you. And I have learned to treat me as I treat you. See, I don't know about loving myself. You know, some people say, well, you can't love others till you love yourself. I don't know about that. That sounds a little, you know, frankly to me, that sounds a little bit conceited and, you know, But I have learned to treat me like I treat you. You know, no better, no worse. If you make a mistake, I don't care. It's okay. My opinion of you does not change. It is my choice whether I love you or not, and I choose to love you, and that's that. You have nothing to say about it. You don't like it, tough. And I just choose to treat me the same way. You know, if I make a mistake, I am not debilitated by it. I'm not paralyzed by it. I just say, hey, I need to do better next time. And I forgive myself. Because you know what I found out? It is really being selfish and self-centered. And that's exactly what our book says our problem is. We are selfish and self-centered. Selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is at the root of our problem. And being selfish and self-centered doesn't mean that you think well of yourself. It means that you think only of yourself. And I say a prayer every morning that says, relieve me of the bondage of self. I just got so tired of hauling me around with me everywhere I went. Me, 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 you know. You know, my prayer was me, 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 me. More, 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 more. Now, 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 now. And I just got tired of hauling me around. You know, I'm just not that much fun. And I learned that from you. And our book says that. And if you can't bear the thought of thinking of yourself all the time, I only know of one way to escape that, and that's to think of others. You know, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. You know, what does God expect me to do to thank Him for the miracle that He's given me? He expects me to share it with you. I think that's exactly what He has in mind when He answers any of our prayers. You don't have to do anything for Him. He's happy that you're sober, that your life's going well. And one of His kids has been straightened up and cleaned up and all. And all He asks is that you share the blessings that He gave you with somebody else. You know, and once you get over the, once you get past the hurdle of thinking of yourself all the time, then once I got past that and could begin to think of you, that's when my life really started getting better. It's true. As long as I only think, if I go, I can go sit in the corner and suck on my thumb and think about me and get suicidal in about 15 minutes. You know, but I have my life goes like this. I have a home group. I'm there at every meeting. I'm there at every business meeting. I am a full participant in my home group. I have a commitment to that group. I consider commitments to be sacred. Sacred. You know, I have learned to have some honor in my life. I had none when I got here, and it is a personal thing. I don't care whether you know I have honor or not. You know, I mention it only because I want you to know it's something that I hold dear to myself. I don't have it for you. I have it for me. And commitments to me are sacred. And the reason they're sacred is because they save my life. See, that home group that I go to every Monday night, and the group Polly and I went to in California every Monday night, 17 years we went to the same group every Monday night. There were times during that 17-year period when I said, I am not going tonight. Those people in that meeting don't care anything at all about me. They never have, and they never will. They don't, and I'm not going. I'm tired of that bunch of phonies. Bunch of do-gooders, holier than thou. Tired of those people. I don't need that. I'm not going. And suddenly, I have a commitment to go. And I go because of my commitment. That's the only reason I go. My head is screaming, let's don't go. I go because I made a commitment to be there. And my honor rests on that. My personal honor rests on that. So I go. And I walk into that, the meeting was in the church. I walk into that church feeling that way. I have never walked out of that church feeling that way. Never. It's just my head says, see if we can mount an attack on old Dave tonight and see if we can knock him off. You know, and so I think commitments are sacred. They keep me in line when I don't want to stay in line. You know, they keep me with you when I don't want to be with you. They keep me with you when my head lies to me. You know, the voice of my commitment is louder than the other voice, old Igor that lives up there in a little box, who's all too willing. Anytime I'm willing to raise the lid on the box, Igor is in there. Dad, 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 dad. You're ugly. You look funny. You dress funny. You smell bad. You look bad. When are you going to get a better car? When are you going to get a better job? You got to leave the lid down on the box, or, you know, there he goes. And once in a while, I raise the lid, and there he is. But I am going to close by telling you a very brief little bit about some of the other things that have happened in my life, and I'm disavowed through. So, you know, I'm a firm believer that the mind can absorb only so long as the butt can endure. So we'll try to get this wrapped up. I had three wives before Polly. I didn't. Who knew you could just live with them? I thought you had to marry them. I had three wives before Polly, and in all three of those marriages, I had stepchildren. And all the stepchildren in all three of those marriages hated me. True, and they should have. That was an appropriate way to react to the way I treated them. Okay, that was appropriate. Those were appropriate feelings. They hated me most of the time. And I married Polly when I was a year, I was 3 years sober. She was four, and she was three. And I have known Polly since she was 6 months sober, and we were friends in AA for about 3 years. And anyway, she had two boys. And I love those two boys more than I can tell you. And one of those boys named his firstborn child after me. You think I did that? No, I don't know how to do that. You did that. That's what you did to me. The other son told me one time that I am the only person he feels really comfortable talking to. That is not my doing. It really isn't. That is the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. My son, I have two children. My son, Michael, died in November of year before last. He's been dead a little over a year. And he was sober 9 years in Alcoholics Anonymous when he died. And he was a spiritual giant. You gave him a life that was beyond his wildest dreams. And he was not, when he died, he was not afraid. And he was courageous and surrounded by family and friends. I had not seen my daughter at the time. I was notified that my son was very sick and was not going to live. I had not seen my daughter at that time for about 15 years. And I didn't want to see her. I didn't want her to call me because my daughter was an alcoholic and a drug addict, doing what alcoholics and drug addicts do. You know, and every time she called me and talked to me, you know, it was just too painful. You know, she'd tell me things that about what she was going to do that, and she wasn't going to do them. And she would tell me things what was going on in her life, and it was all just untrue. You know, it was just the drivel of an alcoholic. And it was painful to her to have to lie to me that way, and it was painful for me to have to hear it. So I was not upset that she didn't call me, you know, as long as that's what it was. But a few hours before my son died, she walked into the room. She got there in time before he died. In fact, you know, he was waiting on her. And then she walked in 8 months, clean and sober. And on March the 10th of last year, I gave her her first year birthday cake. And she's still clean and sober. She's got 2 years. She had 2 years March the 10th. So the last one is in. You know, and our whole family, we are a close, tight family. You know, we all love each other. We all enjoy each other. Alcoholics Anonymous has healed a whole crew. Well, with the exception of one son, but he is not an alcoholic. Rats. He has found his own spiritual path in a place that, you know, who would have thought? The Catholic Church. And our family is thriving. You know, it is thriving. And we are just, you'll see what I mean about my angel if you come tomorrow, because she's pretty spiffy and she's pretty lovable, and you know, she'll get a rebuttal up here, so if, believe me, if I've said anything out of line, you'll know. So here I am. On Sunday, I will be 28 years sober. I'm not a big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really not. You know, I have become comfortable in a room full of you guys because I've been doing it a long time. It's not because I have any special gift or any special talent or any of that stuff. You know, it is my obligation and my duty to do whatever AA asks me to do. You know, and if you need help putting up the chairs, I'll be doing that too. You know, I'm always doing something at my group. Right now I'm the treasurer, but I'm usually on the cleanup committee. And I'm not even the chairman of the cleanup committee. I'm just the guy that cleans up. You know, and I consider that an honor to be able to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous because of what I've been given. You know, I am grateful. There is absolutely nothing that feels any better than gratitude. Just being grateful. And in the meantime, I'm just trying to grow up to be the kind of guy my little dog thinks I am. Thank you.